The housing crisis in America was one of the first dominoes to fall in the current financial meltdown.
We will look for additional measures to reach more borrowers and prevent as many avoidable foreclosures as possible.
That's Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson on Meet the Press in August. It's still a problem. What does that mean for the next administration? Today, we'll add a few pages to America's briefing book for President-elect Barack Obama. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, November 18th. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, good morning, Adora. Along with the discussion on housing, we're also going to look at the massive layoffs at Citigroup. Another briefing book, this time on immigration reform, plus the 30th anniversary of the Jonestown Massacre, the Bible's buried secrets, and pirates at sea. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
The heads of GM, Ford, and Chrysler will make their case today before the Senate Banking Committee. They're asking for $25 billion in loans, and Democratic supporters such as Maryland's Barbara Mikulski says it will help.
The 30,000 American dealerships in this country are at risk of losing 37,000 jobs. We can't let this happen. We can't let the American automobile industry implode.
It's going to be a tough sell with key Republicans. Here's Arizona Senator John Kyle on the Senate floor yesterday.
It does no good for taxpayers to pour $25 billion into the car companies and find that a year later that money has been spent and yet nothing has changed.
In the House, Democrat Barney Frank says the car companies would have just 1 year to pay back the money. Still, the plan is not likely to pass. And in a cost-cutting move, Ford slashed its stake in Mazda by nearly two-thirds.
Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke will also be at Capitol Hill this morning again. Now they're going to be talking to the House Financial Services Committee, explaining why they decided to ditch the original plan to snap up bad assets in favor of investing $250 billion directly into banks. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is asking the Bush administration to declare the southern part of his state a federal disaster area. That's after three wildfires burned through nearly 1,000 homes. Only one of the fires is fully contained.
The Navy says Saturday's hijacking of a giant oil tanker by Somali pirates is unprecedented and marks a fundamental shift in the pirates' capabilities. The tanker is now off the coast of Somalia and the crew is safe, but the Navy's encouraging ship owners to place armed teams on vessels.
Yahoo co-founder Jerry Yang is stepping down as CEO. Also, oil prices lingered near $55 a barrel Tuesday in Asian trading. The Dow and the S&P were both down a little more than 2.5% yesterday, and the Dow closed at 82.73, the S&P at 850.
And on Capitol Hill, the topic number one is the bailout, not only the financial bailout for banks, but also for the auto industry. Billions and billions of dollars are heading out of the Treasury. Who should get that money? Who is in the greatest need? Which part of the economy most affects you? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. Now, Adora, as you know, one of the largest layoffs of any industry was yesterday when Citigroup said they're eliminating some 52,000 jobs, nearly 15% of their workforce. It's a stunning move and really highlights the woes of the financial sector. And to get more, we're going to go today to David Enrich. He's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and he's covering the story for today's paper. Hey, David, thanks for coming by.
My pleasure.
All right. Now, some of these cuts were already underway. So what exactly changed yesterday?
They've made clear for the first time exactly the scope of the layoffs and the job cuts that they were going to be facing. And frankly, it was about on par with what people had expected. And but it really did, for people who have been following it closely, and more casual observers, it really underscores the magnitude of the stress in the financial services industry, though.
Now, what sectors of the company are affected?
And really throughout. The hardest hit will be the investment bank, especially here in New York, also in London. But and their Smith Barney unit also could be affected. Really, the scope of it could be pretty wide and jarring. It's also – and it's really all over the world, though, in Germany and India. And it's really going to force the company probably to pare back some of its operations around the world
as
well.
What prompted this move?
Well, just the broad, very deep, very broad financial stress. And the company has, over the past year, faced about $20 billion in losses. Their CEO is under enormous and mounting pressure to do something about it. He's facing a lot of pressure from the board, from shareholders, and frankly, just from employees who have been hearing these rumblings about mass layoffs in the past couple weeks and are really on edge. And it's really, really hard to operate and do your job effectively when you're facing the pressure of being laid off.
How do you cope? I mean, I'm assuming the workload stays the same. So how do you do it?
Well, the workload, it actually gets bigger because, you know, these layoffs have been taking place kind of on a rolling basis for the past several weeks now. And morale at Citigroup, I talked to a lot of people at the company, is just pitifully low.
And I guess what's interesting about what was announced yesterday is, given what happened with Goldman Sachs over the weekend, where you had all of these executives who said they're going to forego their bonuses, there was not a murmur from Citigroup about potentially foregoing bonuses for their executives who have seen multiple months of losses.
Yeah, and they've been racking up losses for the past year now, and it's not like they just didn't mention the bonus issue. I mean, they were pressed on it by a lot of reporters, and including myself, and are just refusing to budge on the issue. And I think they face a real political problem here. And not only is Goldman and probably some other firms saying and asking their boards not to give them bonuses, but Citigroup is receiving $25 billion in government capital here. And the optical problem, at the very least, of receiving that money and potentially doling out and sizable bonuses to their top executives and it's probably untenable. I think they're going to face real pressure to not pay those bonuses.
You add to that, now you're talking about up to 75,000 people around the world that are losing their jobs.
Yeah, well, and in fairness, in terms of the people losing their jobs, this is a lot of these people, and tens of thousands of people will lose their jobs. Tens of thousands of people included in this number will no longer work for Citigroup, but Citigroup's counting those numbers. Those numbers include people whose business units will be sold, essentially. So it gets off Citigroup's books. It doesn't necessarily mean they get fired.
I was just going to say, there are other moves that are going along with this. What exactly are they selling off?
And they've already sold off their banking business in Germany. They have an outsourcing unit based in India that they've sold.
Who's buying?
Other financial services companies. And I think that's one of the problems Citigroup faces. And they've got their Primerica business, which is here in the U.S. It's an insurance and mutual fund business that they've been trying to sell for months. And apparently they're getting closer to finding a buyer, but, you know, they're going to sell for pennies on the dollar in today's market.
Well, in fact, what is the path that is open to Citigroup? I mean, there are some analysts who say, you know, that one of the things that really hurt them was that they missed out on that chance to buy Wachovia. That Wells Fargo.
Yeah.
Talk about that for a minute.
And that was a really devastating blow for Citigroup. And right now, Citigroup, like all other banks, they really need people have been pulling deposits, not out of Citigroup specifically, but out of the industry in general. And there's just a lot more concern among investors and regulators. And Citigroup needs to either get bigger or probably sell itself, honestly. And
who would buy then?
I don't think there are very many good options there. So they're in a real quandary.
And also, historically, aren't they bad at absorbing other businesses?
They have one of the worst track records in the financial services industry for integrating mergers, which is one of the reasons that people are looking around. They're seeing that Citigroup is in talks to buy some other banks. And it makes them real nervous, because if they go and buy a bunch of banks, the track record is not good.
And in fact, there's already a candidate, right, that they're looking at.
Yeah, they're in talks to buy a bank down in Maryland in the Washington, D.C. area, but it's small and doesn't really move the needle that much for
them.
Okay,
and to wrap up here, the stock price for Citigroup, what's going on with that?
It is under $9 for the first time in about 13 years. It's, it was at 50-some dollars 15 months ago, so it's really been quite a ride for Citigroup investors.
All right. David Enrich, I want to thank you for coming by.
It's my pleasure.
David Enrich, Wall Street Journal reporter on the Citigroup layoffs.
We're going to completely change the topic here and talk about Somali pirates. All year they've been stepping up their attacks, and this week they seized the largest take anyone can recall. They hijacked a Saudi Arabian oil supertanker, and it stunned experts for its brazen and bold take hundreds of miles off the Horn of Africa, kidnapping the 25-member crew and taking control of $100 million of crude oil. Joining us now for more is Lieutenant Nathan Christensen with the U.S. Navy, and he joins us from Bahrain. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me today.
Clearly a sign of growing ambition. Who are these pirates? Is it a mafia-like ring?
Well, you know, we believe them to be pirates from Somalia who have captured over 80 vessels this year. Now, I will tell you that what's really concerning about this is not only is it the largest vessel that has been attacked, over 300,000 metric tons, and to put this in some perspective for you, it's almost three times the tonnage size of a U.S. naval aircraft carrier, so an extremely large vessel. But it also occurred more than 450 miles off the coast of Mombasa, Kenya, the furthest out to sea we've seen any attack. Recently, the furthest out we've seen is about 200 miles. So this really represents a fundamental shift in the pirates' ability to be able to attack vessels at sea.
And this seems to have been a growing trend this year, bolder attacks, and it seems to be working. They seize these ships, they demand ransoms, and they get paid. What are they doing with the money?
Well, you know, that's a great question. That's typically what we have seen. They've continued to attack vessels, continue to get ransom payments, and then from there they'll go on and attack the next vessels. Now, I will tell you that while the amount of attacks may look like they're up, since the U.S. Navy and the coalition's involvement here, since August heavily into this, I can tell you that the amount of attacks have actually decreased by about 20%. So the effort that we're having here in the short term is bearing some fruit.
And what kind of effort is it? Is it an international effort, since you're talking about tankers and ships that come from all over the world and involve crews that are multinational?
It really is. You know, I mean, piracy is a problem that starts ashore, and it's an international problem that really requires an international solution. And as a result, we've kind of taken the lead here, and we've worked with the IMO and the IMB to.
You want to tell us what those are, IMO and IMB?
Yes, ma'am. The International Maritime Organization and the International Maritime Bureau, based out of London and then Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. So essentially what we've done is we've started working with these organizations and countries' navies from throughout the world. And we've established what we call a maritime security patrol area, where we know the highest amount of attacks to be occurring in the Gulf of Aden specifically. And we've recommended a recommended traffic corridor to help these ships transit through the area. And so what we'll do is we have concentrated ships, you know, to deter acts of piracy in between Somalia and Yemen and the Gulf of Aden. We've also been working with shipping companies really to recommend that they take self-protection measures themselves. And this can include embarking security teams, as well as taking evasive maneuvering when they feel threatened or are under attack.
Lieutenant Nathan Christensen, thanks so much for being with us. Lieutenant Nathan Christensen is the deputy spokesman with the U.S. Navy in Bahrain. Today we are talking about debt. We're doing a series this week, and we're looking at a variety of slices. And we want to hear your stories about debt.
I purchased a condominium over 2 years ago, and my original monthly payment was $800. Unbeknownst to me, I had an adjusted rate mortgage. I now pay $2,100 a month. I got sick, and between my co-pays and the medicines, because I don't have medicine coverage, I've racked up about $25,000 on my credit card statements.
Today, we're talking about housing debt. Do you owe more than your house is worth? Tell us your story, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
And good morning. It's Tuesday, November 18th. I'm Catherine Lanford in for John Hockenberry. We're continuing with our presidential briefing book. Today, a look at immigration, always a hot-button issue. But with the floundering economy, it eventually took a back seat in this year's election. There are between 12 to 13 million unauthorized immigrants in the U.S. today, and both parties agree that we need reform. Well, to get some advice for the incoming administration, we're turning now to Douglas Massey. He's a professor of sociology at Princeton University and the author of Beyond Smoke and Mirrors, U.S. Immigration Policy in the Age of Globalization. He joins us by phone. All right, Douglas, let's say that you are President-elect Obama's advisor on immigration. You know that 78% of the Latino immigrants voted for him. How are you going to start this conversation?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is to realize that we've dug ourselves into a deep hole and we have to do something about the 12 million people out of status. I divide them into three groups. The first group were people that entered the country as minors in the company of their parents. There are about 3 million of them, and they didn't do anything wrong. I think it's a moral imperative that we grant these people an amnesty because they were often toddlers and children when they entered the United States, and they're not guilty of anything except obeying their parents. For the people who entered the country as adults, I think the thing we need to do is to set up a guest worker program for those who don't want to remain here and would rather stay home and only circulate back and forth. And for those who have put down roots here and want to stay, I'd advocate an earned legalization program where they, over time, earn points towards permanent resident status. Perhaps at the end, if you want to punish them for breaking the law, you fine them, but you do provide a pathway to permanent residence in the end. In this way, you'll bring everybody out of the shadows, give them labor rights in the United States, allow them to unionize, allow them to compete fairly in American labor markets, and don't put downward pressure on American workers.
Okay, now, given how the economy looms, as we said, what room, if any, does this administration have to address immigration reform in the much-vaunted first 100 days?
Well, I don't think it's going to be a priority for the Obama administration in the first 100 days. The economic meltdown is so great and so vast right now that that's got to consume most of their attention for the first 100 days. They will pay off a few of the promises they made, like perhaps closing Guantanamo and starting troop withdrawals from Iraq. But the main focus is going to be on the economy and how to salvage the disastrous performance that the Republicans have had after 8 years. I think that if there's a movement on immigration reform, it will probably come from Congress. Congress may put together some interim steps like the DREAM Act, which would allow these children who came into the United States as minors to legalize and go on to college. That's the least controversial of the provisions. I think after the first 100 days, if the economy can stabilize, then there's some possibility for moving forward on immigration reform, because the electorate is not worked up about it. And that's because John McCain was the Republican candidate, and because he's co-author of the main immigration reform bill, and made it impossible for him to use immigration as a wedge issue to stir up the electorate and attack the Democrats. So,
Professor, where do you think the political will is going to come from to make a U-turn on immigration policy? Currently, we're building a wall. The U.S. has hired more border patrol agents, and we're hearing a lot more about massive raids all over the country. Where does that come to make those changes that you just outlined, all of which there's certainly been much debate?
Well, I don't think it's so much a U-turn for American public opinion, because if you look at the opinion polls, substantial majorities favor most of the provisions that I outlined for immigration reform. The U-turn can some of the U-turn can be enacted simply by order of the president. So you can stop building the wall, you can stop expansion of the border patrol, and you can shift gears in those small ways right away. And then I think in the case of broader reform, it's really been a case of tail wagging the dog. We've had about 20% of the electorate that is dead set against doing anything for immigrants and very hostile to immigrants. And they've managed to create a climate in the past where people who would normally vote for immigration reform were afraid to do so for the political consequences. But I think the electoral tides have shifted, as we've seen in the last election, and there is possibility for a compromise on this issue and some movement forward. If it gets out of Congress, Obama will sign it.
All right. Very quickly, as we're nearing the end, how you think that we should look to the European Union for guidance? Give me one thing they're doing that we should be doing.
Well, the European Union has a great history of absorbing into a broader economic union countries at a much lower standard of living, allowing them to get free labor mobility, but in return for free labor mobility, providing them with some adjustment funds to bring them up to the levels of the European Union so that when unification happens, the markets integrate, there's not a massive out-movement of labor. This happened for Spain and Portugal in the past, and it's happening for places like Poland and Romania now.
All right. Douglas Massey, I want to thank you for joining us.
Sure.
And we're going to turn now to Mark Garrison. He is sitting in for Femi Okeh.
Thank you. Coming up on 28 minutes after the hour, today Congress hears from the chiefs of the big three automakers. The companies want a slice of the $700 billion rescue plan. Expect something of a sob story. GM says it doesn't even have enough money to make it through the end of the year. Democrats support aid to automakers from those bailout funds. The Bush administration wants that money reserved for banks and other financial firms. The White House is trying to make air travel a bit easier for the 24 million people expected to fly over Thanksgiving. For the second year in a row, President Bush is opening up two military airways on the East Coast. This is an effort to cut congestion. For their part, the Air Traffic Controllers Union is skeptical it can make a difference. Firefighters are making progress battling three wildfires in Southern California. A Santa Barbara fire is close to being fully contained. Fires in San Fernando Valley and Los Angeles are about half contained. More than 30 people have been injured in the fires. A new government report finds Gulf War illness is real, and it affects some one in four veterans from the 1991 conflict. Previous reports have denied the illness actually exists. Symptoms include chronic headaches, fatigue, and pain. The report could not identify a cure for the disease. Last year saw the highest number of hungry children in the U.S. in a decade. The Department of Agriculture reports that number was almost 700,000 kids, which shot up 50% from a year earlier. So Baz Luhrmann has a kind of big epic film, Australia, that's coming out. Huge epic, big budget, lots of stars, Nicole Kidman, you know, Hugh Jackman, et cetera. And Australia apparently officially they'll get a tourism boost. Now, that kind of makes sense because it's attractive. It's kind of like Lord of the Rings, you know, boosted.
New Zealand, exactly.
So you had that, and like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. But then what I found out in the article, they also mentioned that the last time they got a big boost was when Crocodile Dundee came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine because it just like reinforces the worst stereotypes. Like why would people see that? And then like, I got to go to Australia. It didn't quite make sense to me.
Well, people wanted to say good day, mate.
Yeah.
That didn't work for you. All right.
Yeah, I'm
Thank
staying
you.
Here.
Okay. All right. Mark Garrison.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry today. So good morning to you, Catherine.
Hey, Adora.
And this week on The Takeaway, we're taking a hard look at debt as part of a series. So every day this week, we're going to be taking a different slice of it. And today, we're concentrating on housing. The housing crisis has become a critical part of the financial meltdown, and millions of Americans are in real trouble with foreclosures. Foreclosures are up 71% from last year. What's more, nearly a quarter of all homeowners are at risk of owing more than their home is worth. For more now, we turn to Richard K. Green, the director and chair of the University of Southern California's Lusk Center for Real Estate. Professor, good morning. A very good early morning there in Los Angeles.
Yes, it is early, but good morning to you, too.
So where do we even start in this discussion? Where are we in the housing market? Is there any sense that we've hit a bottom?
No, I actually was feeling better about getting close to a bottom before September 15th, because we saw prices fall so much in so many parts of the country that owning was starting to look like a reasonably good deal relative to renting. But with the lack of confidence that has happened because of the financial crisis, I don't think we're close to a bottom now, although I did think so 6 weeks to 2 months ago.
That's interesting that you would say September 15th, because we have a bit of sound from Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson on the 15th talking about the housing market.
There is a reasonable chance that the biggest part of that housing correction can be behind us in a number of months.
So, Professor, you weren't alone, but now you are rethinking what you thought as well as what the Secretary thought.
Yes, well, a couple of important things happened. One is, of course, credit markets, which were already kind of dicey, just fell apart completely with Lehman Brothers, the failure of Lehman Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ability of people to get mortgages is it's much harder for people to get mortgages now than it was just 6-7 weeks ago. And without easy access to credit, or at least easier access to credit, it just makes it very difficult for people to buy houses. But the other thing is, as this crisis of confidence has worsened, people are not willing to make the kind of long-term commitment that buying a house involved. So people who maybe 3 months ago were thinking about buying now are just too uncertain about the future to be willing to put themselves on the hook for a commitment like buying a house.
Given those several issues that you just presented, on a macro level, what do you think the government can and should do?
Well, it's the government needs to try to do something, but we're struggling, and it's hard to know what can work. I think the problem is we've tried incremental solutions to this point, and incremental solutions just aren't going to do it. Two things have to happen in order for people to feel comfortable with their mortgages again and for the housing market to restart. The first thing is people have to have houses that are worth more than their mortgages. And as you noted in your introduction, we are having an increasing number of people whose mortgage balances are actually higher than the value of their houses. And that means, one, there's an incentive to default in the event that they get into trouble. But the other thing it means is, even if people don't want to default, they can't sell their house unless they're willing to pony up some cash. And so getting those mortgage balances down, at least for the time being, is really important. And the second thing is making payments affordable to people. So for right now, people who are paying 40 or 50% of their income on housing are not going to be able to keep doing that. That's not going to be sustainable. So figuring out how to get that payment down is really important, too. That said, the only way that can happen is to come up with a plan that is very comprehensive and probably pretty expensive.
Some banks, as you've noted, have been working or setting up programs to work with homeowners in order to make those payments more realistic so that they can actually make them. What's your advice to individuals who find themselves in that situation where their mortgage is worth more than the value of their home?
Well, it depends on their individual situation. If they can pay their payment comfortably, so let's say their mortgage payment is 20% of their income, and they're still in good shape with their job, even though they're underwater, they should just keep paying because they need to live somewhere. And the fact is, if you default, you're going to have a hard time finding a landlord who's eager to rent to you. So if you're comfortable making the payments, if you're not stressed making the payments, then the best thing to do is keep making the payments. But if you are stretched, if you are one of those people who is in sort of the 40% to 50% of income going to mortgage payment category, it's in your best interest to go talk to your lender and see if you can get a workout on the loan. Because what we're finding is there are people who are being called by servicers, who are the people who are responsible for making sure mortgages stay current. And the people are being called by the servicer, and they're not returning the call because they're afraid to. And it's much better to deal with the situation and talk to the lender about working things out, because it's never in the lender's interest to have a foreclosure. They don't want your house on their books. And then finally, for people who have lost their jobs, who are in parts of the country where the prospect for getting a job are pretty remote, So think about the Rust Belt, for example. I think the only rational decision in some cases is just to default and move to a part of the country where there are jobs available.
Okay, Professor. Banks are certainly more likely to be flexible in these economic times. Richard Green, professor and director and chair of the University of Southern California's USC Lusk Center for Real Estate. Thanks for being with us. Now it's your turn to tell us your story. How is housing debt affecting you? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now we're going to go to Mark Garrison, who's got the latest headlines of the morning for us.
Sure do. Coming up on 21 minutes before the hour. And news just out this hour, wholesale prices plunged a record amount. They're down 2.8%. That is the biggest drop in more than two decades. So it could be a challenging day on Wall Street. Futures are down a bit at the moment. A lot of nervousness about the U.S. auto industry. A collapse could mean widespread job losses. Trading in Europe is also down a bit after Asia finished lower. One bright spot is Yahoo stock. It's up in pre-market trading. That's after CEO Jerry Yang announced he's stepping down. He will remain on the board. Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke testified today before the House Financial Services Committee. They'll be defending their new plan to inject money directly into banks through investment. They originally planned to use the bailout money to buy up bad assets. And while Southern California recovers from the most recent wildfires, officials have arrested a 16-year-old for starting a separate California blaze in July. The so-called Gap Fire burned 9,500 acres in the Santa Barbara area. There are still three fires burning right now. A survey by a foundation that promotes better doctor-patient relationships finds that nearly half of the doctors who responded would get out of medicine if they could. More than 12,000 doctors responded to the Physician Foundation's questionnaire. More frustrated are family doctors or internists, who are considered to be the backbone of the industry. And also just surfing around our partners at the BBC, and their headline today was Tourists in India in Samosa Shock. Not the only headline, just like their kind of culinary coverage. So I have a, you know, interest in fried pastries stuffed with potatoes and peas and dipped in hot sauce. So I was curious about that. But it turns out it was a story of a Dutch tourist couple being ripped off. They paid $200 for just a few plates of samosa. So that, you know, a cautionary tale from the BBC this morning.
Thank you, Mark, very much.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. Today we note the 30th anniversary of the Jonestown mass suicide. That's the voices of the people from Jonestown, a choir brought together by a charismatic preacher named Jim Jones, the founder of the People's Temple. Here he is at a healing ceremony on a tape collected by the FBI.
Little things to build your faith, because it's important now. We're dealing with some serious matters.
Thank you, Father.
Jones convinced hundreds to help build his socialist paradise in rural Guyana, preaching that healing, racial equality, and predicting the end of the world. Listen very carefully to this tape he secretly recorded of a devoted member.
I've been here 1 year and 9 months, and I never felt better in my life, not in San Francisco, but until I came to Jonestown. I've enjoyed this life. I've had a beautiful life. And I don't see nothing for us to be crying about. We should be happy. happy. At least I am. That's how you're going to be safe.
Jonestown was isolated, and the people who joined left behind a trail of concerned family members. It all began to unravel 30 years ago when California Congressman Leo Ryan showed up to investigate alleged human rights abuses.
I'm very glad to be here. This is a congressional inquiry, and I think that all of you know that I'm here to find out more about questions that have been raised about your operation here.
Members had sold their belongings, given their savings to the church, and severed family ties. Though the congressman was set to leave, describing the community in, quote, basically good terms, it was the beginning of the end of Jonestown.
The Air Force C-141 transport arrived at Andrews Air Force Base shortly after 9 o'clock, bearing six patients. Among them,
as Congressman Ryan, his staff, journalists, and 15 defecting members of the People's Temple tried to leave, Jones's security team, the Red Brigade, shot Ryan and four others dead on the tarmac. Jim Jones considered it the end of the struggle, fearing his congregation, including children, would be tortured by hostile forces in retaliation.
It's all over, all over. What a legacy, what a legacy. But the Red Brigade's the only ones that ever made any sense anyway. They invaded our privacy, they came into our home, they followed us 6,000 miles away. The Red Brigade showed them justice. The congressman's dead.
Moments later, Jones pulled out vats of Flavor Aid, not Kool-Aid as the urban legend goes, containing Valium, cyanide, and more, a deadly cocktail, and he urged members to commit revolutionary suicide, protesting what he called an inhumane world. Among the group, there was a dissenter. Listen as Christine Miller protests.
I said I'm afraid to die.
I don't think you are. I don't think you are.
But, I look at our babies and I think they deserve to live.
I agree.
You know?
But also they deserve, what's more, they deserve peace.
Authorities found the bodies of more than 900 adults and children on November 18, 1978. Jim Jones and Christine Miller among them. It was and still is the largest mass suicide in American history.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, November 18th. Mark Garrison has the latest headlines. He's sitting in for Femi Okeh. Mark?
Thank you. It's coming up on 12 minutes before the hour. A new study has found a possible link between in vitro fertilization and birth defects. In vitro babies are as much as four times as likely to have birth defects that can include cleft lips, heart defects, and other problems. The researchers can't put their finger on the cause of the link. More than 1% of the babies in the U.S. are conceived using in vitro methods. The BBC reports U.K. health officials are promoting fun and games to teach children about antibiotic-resistant bacteria or superbugs. Overusing antibiotics is thought to foster bacteria that can become immune to antibiotics, and they say teenagers can play a role in stopping the bugs. Other European countries can start using the campaign materials next year. Today, residents of the Great Lakes and Northeast will see a lot of snow outside their windows. Strong winds are expected across the Great Lakes and dump heavy snow on Michigan and Ohio. You could get snow as far east as the Finger Lakes region, and that is the news.
All right. Thanks, Mark. All right, here are two big questions for you. When was the Bible written and who actually wrote it? Those are two of the questions examined by a new NOVA documentary, a program that uses archaeology to come up with answers. Gary Glassman wrote, directed, and produced this documentary, The Bible's Buried Secrets. It's a production of our partner WGBH, and it's airing tonight on local PBS stations. Gary's joining us from Providence, Rhode Island. Okay, Gary Glassman, this documentary focuses on the first five books of the Bible. What's the story there?
Well, the first five books of the Bible are often called the Torah, or the books of Moses. And what literary scholars have discovered is, in fact, that although it's been assumed that these books were written by somebody named Moses. The first five books were written by four groups of writers over hundreds of years and were compiled during the time of the Babylonian exile, when Jerusalem had been destroyed and the temple to the Israelite God had been ransacked and burned to the ground.
Now, you mentioned that there were four authors. Talk a little bit more. There was a preview of this documentary, and it was then deemed controversial. What sort of questions swirl about the authorship of the Bible?
Well, once you take the authorship out of the hands of God and put it into the human hands, then people who only see the Bible as in one way take exception to it. But the reality is that the Bible is a foundational text for 3 billion people and who are Jews, Christians, and Muslims. But it's also a very important book for our Western civilization. And so there are many different ways of reading the Bible rather than just the Word of God.
And what are the central questions that you wanted to answer in this program?
Well, we looked at the origins of the Israelites. Who were they? Where did they come from? How, when, why the Bible was written? And how did the Israelites find their one God?
In fact, let's talk about the role of archaeology, how you had these questions and you wanted the answers to be intersected with science.
Well, we were looking for what we called convergences, looking at the Bible looking at the archaeology and also sources outside the Bible to find places where they converge, where there would be some sense of these stories resonating with historical documents. The first place that we find a major convergence is actually on something called the Merneptah Stela. Merneptah was the pharaoh of Egypt, the son of Ramses II, probably the greatest pharaoh in
and
Egyptian
the Stela,
history.
I mean, we're basically talking about a big boasting record, right?
That's right.
I did. Here's who I conquered. I'm
That's
so
right.
great.
Right. Everyone should have one of those.
Yeah.
Yes,
Don't you have one at home?
It's about a 12-foot granite stone carved, and on that stone it lists a whole bunch of foreign people that Pharaoh has conquered, and one of those people he says is Israel, and he says, "I've wiped the seed of Israel from the face of the earth." Well, obviously he didn't. It actually marked their entrance onto the world stage.
I want to talk about one of the more controversial aspects, and that is the idea, the artifacts suggesting that God had a wife. What are we talking about here?
Well, here again, yes, we were very fortunate. First of all, we had access to, you know, incredible sites, archaeological sites throughout Egypt, Israel, and Syria. And we happened to be right there at Tel Rehov, an ancient Israelite site in the Jordan Valley, when the archaeologists there uncovered a figurine, a clay figurine, that they identified as Asherah, who is a Canaanite goddess, a fertility goddess, and this was in an Israelite home. Well, it turns out there have been thousands of these figurines found in Israelite homes, and right up until the destruction of the Jerusalem temple. And so the archaeological record clearly shows that the Israelites were worshiping other gods much longer than certainly we were taught in Sunday school. But interestingly, if you look at the Bible, if you read the Bible, the prophets are always railing against the Israelites worshiping other gods. So here, in a way, is a convergence, another convergence that sheds light on how ordinary people were actually practicing their religion.
You know, we have some sound here of one of the archaeologists talking about finding one of these figurines you talk about. Let's listen.
Well, we just found this beautiful, exceptional clay figurine showing a goddess, a fertility goddess, that was worshipped here in Israel. Here, in this case, she's shown holding a baby.
Wow. So that was Amhai Mazur, one of the archaeologists you were working with. I want you to listen to another piece of audio, just because I love how excited this particular archaeologist is. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what he's doing.
When I got home and brushed it off, I thought I was going to have a heart attack. Executed in clear 8th century script. It's a tomb inscription. And it just gives the name of the deceased and says, "Blessed may X be by Yahweh." That's good biblical Hebrew. But it says by Yahweh and his Asherah. And Asherah is the name of the old Canaanite mother goddess.
And that's archaeologist Bill Deaver. What's he telling us there?
Well, that inscription talks, that's God's wife, basically.
Right.
That's his evidence for God having a wife. And as Bill says, not only did he have a wife, but he had many girlfriends, too.
Okay, you are courting controversy. As we wrap this up, talk about faith and science, and how many truths can we walk around holding?
Well, when we screened this in New York at the Interfaith Center last week and had representatives of the three monotheistic religions, these people were very excited about the possibility that just as monotheism was an evolutionary process for the Israelites and actually came out of perhaps their most tragic moment in history, we may be sitting right now on the verge of a new evolutionary leap forward where monotheism can be embraced in a more, shall I say, more secular spiritual, as a more secular spiritual concept that really unites all of us.
Okay, Gary Glassman, I want to thank you for your time. Gary Glassman is president and ex-executive producer of Providence Pictures, and The Bible's Buried Secrets airs tonight at 8 p.m. on your local PBS station, a production of our partner, WGBH. Adora?
We're always on at The Takeaway. Today we put another page in Barack Obama's briefing book, this about immigration. And here's a thought from you.
My name is Rosita Lopez, and I'm calling from Fairview, New Jersey. Immigration reform would be good. 12 million more people would pay taxes.
Here's a thought. We're also doing a series on debt in America. Today we're focusing on housing debt. We'd like to hear your story. Go to thetakeaway.org, or you can always give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And of course, if you missed anything, you could take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at our website or on iTunes.
I'm Catherine Lanfer.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
What happens when a member of your Democratic Party wanders off message?
I believe there should be consequences. At the same time, we need for him to remain in our caucus. And the question is to find a balance, a sense of balance here that reflects our disappointment, in some cases profound disappointment, with really his criticism of Senator Obama.
That's Delaware Democratic Senator Tom Carper talking about Senator Joe Lieberman, who was a Democrat turned independent, turned friend of Republican presidential candidate John McCain. Today, Lieberman learns his fate. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, November 18th. Catherine Landfer is in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Catherine.
Hey, Adora. Along with the fate of Senator Lieberman, we're also this hour going to be looking at that lame duck Congress that convenes this week, along with the potential candidates for the Obama cabinet and the Mexican smuggling wars crossing the border into Arizona. We'll also talk about a looming ecological disaster out west. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
Wall Street's likely to follow Asian and European markets downward today, especially with the latest news of a record drop in wholesale prices in the U.S. They dropped 2.8% last month, the biggest one-month decline on record that go back more than 60 years. The markets are also shaky as investors hold their breath to see whether Congress will loan the big three automakers $25 billion the companies are asking for. The heads of GM, Ford, and Chrysler will make their case before the Senate Banking Committee today, but they're facing a tough crowd with Republican opponents like Arizona's John Kyle.
It does no good for taxpayers to pour $25 billion into the car companies and find that a year later that money has been spent and yet nothing has changed.
The so-called lame duck Congress could vote on the plan this week.
Also on Capitol Hill this morning, again, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke. They're expected to be grilled about the decision to ditch their original plan to snap up bad assets in favor of a plan to invest $250 billion directly into banks. Also today, the Iraqi cabinet decided to hold elections on January 31st, the first provincial elections in 3 years. The upcoming elections are viewed as a way to balance the sectarian split between the Sunnis and the Shias, and that is according to Iraq's envoy to the UN.
The Navy says Saturday's hijacking of a giant oil tanker by Somali pirates is unprecedented and marks a fundamental shift in the pirates' capabilities. The tanker is now off the coast of Somalia and the crew is safe, but the Navy's encouraging shipowners to place armed teams on vessels.
Oil prices lingered near $55 a barrel on Tuesday in Asian trading. The Dow and the S&P were both down a little more than 2.5% yesterday, Dow closing at 82.73, the S&P at 850. Now, the government's financial bailout plan is topping the agenda today. The big three automakers also asking for money. Where do you think all this money should go? What does Congress need to fix first? What part of the economy most affects you? Call us with your ideas at 1-877-778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Landfer, in for John Hockenberry. It's day two of Congress's lame duck session. Republicans and Democrats alike are gearing up for the first skirmishes in what promises to be quite the battle to remake the U.S. economy. So here are two questions. Are we going to bail out the big three automakers? And by the way, what is the fate of Senator Joe Lieberman? Todd Zwillick is a reporter for PRI's Capital News Connections, and he's joining us from Capitol Hill this morning. All right, Todd, let's talk economy before politics. What's going to happen with the auto bailout?
Well, if you're an executive at one of the big three, you're probably not feeling great about it at this point. And the main reason for that is the 60-vote threshold in the Senate. Keep in mind, this is still the 110th Congress, not the 111th. So all of those gains that Democrats have made in the election, they haven't taken effect yet. Those new senators don't have a vote on the floor yet. So it's still 51-49 in the Senate, and 51 is not enough to get you to 60, obviously. And there are a lot of Republicans, and many of them took to the floor yesterday, who are not in favor of $25 billion or anything approaching it for the auto industry. We'll see what happens in hearings today. But without convincing a lot of Republicans, and even a couple of Democrats who've thrown a little bit of cold water on this, without that, they're not going to get that in this 110th Congress.
Todd, what's the fundamental resistance to bailing out the auto industry? Everyone's got an opinion about the auto industry. Obviously, this is a very sensitive time in the economy. But what's the fundamental reason for not acting right now?
Well, I think you heard the crux of it in Senator Kyle's remarks in the audio that you played, which is basically $25 billion now without fundamental changes to the way these companies are doing business, their union contracts, the billions they spend on health care and pensions. Without fundamentally changing that, it's throwing good money after bad.
But why not demand those changes then? Give the money in exchange. I think, as Barack Obama indicated yesterday, that it couldn't be a blank check without some kind of conditions.
Well, I think then you get into the weeds of what those conditions actually look like and what a lot of Republicans want. First of all, philosophically, this is the same argument that was made with the bigger bailout of the financial industry. A lot of Republicans philosophically believe that businesses that are failing should be allowed to fail. And they've had quite enough of this bailout of industries. It goes against their principles. So that's point one. And then point two, another thing that Kyle said yesterday is that's what Chapter 11 is for, Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Let them go into Chapter 11, let them restructure, let them slim down, let them let go whom they need to let go, change those contracts, and then we can talk about supporting them, but not before.
What discussion are you hearing, though, about the fact that in some ways this is much more about not only the jobs at the automakers, but at the suppliers and the ripple effect as it goes on and on and on?
Well, of course. And you hear that discussion a lot. And that's the argument on the Democratic side. And many Republicans acknowledge that as well. You hear that argument being made strongly by the Michigan delegation and by delegations with assembly plants, assembly plants, parts plants in their states. So this is the tug of war that's going on. And part of the dynamic, of course, is that this Congress is leaving soon and a new administration is coming soon.
So I was just going to say, how much of this is time is of the essence? I mean, how much of this is we only have a few days of this lame duck session, and how much of it is the fact, what if they don't get the help this week? Then what happens?
Well, if they don't get the help this week, then it's wait and see. GM... Some executives from GM have said, we might not be here in January when you guys come back. Or if we do, we'll be further damaged. It will be even more expensive to save this industry then. So cheaper to do something now than to do something in January or February. If they don't manage to do something this week, it'll be wait and see. And I would be surprised if you don't see the big three come back in January as soon as there's a new Congress and try to ask again.
Before we get to politics, let's look at the other side of the bailout, and that would be the overall $700 billion financial bailout package. What kind of action do you think we're going to see on that this week with the lame duck session?
Well, the Fed chairman and Hank Paulson, the Treasury secretary, were up here last night, and they're up here again this morning in the House Financial Services Committee. So the question now is about $290 billion has already been spent. They have the $700 total, and it comes in here's the math. It comes in $350 billion blocks. So they're getting close to the end of the first $350 billion. To get the next $350 billion, the administration has to ask Congress. And they're getting to that point where you start to say, will Paulson ask for the next slice or will he kick it to his successor in the Obama administration? Paulson has said so far, and I think told the Wall Street Journal, that he doesn't want to ask for that money. He wants to hold it in reserve to get more punch from it. But if events unfold and volatility keeps being what it is on the stock market, he may have to ask for it. Now, in the rules, if he asks for it and Congress isn't around, they may have to reconvene yet again to approve it, or they could to block it, or they could stay away altogether and the administration would get their money automatically. I think you'll probably hear some of those dynamics come up this morning in Barney Frank's committee, whether or not Hank Paulson intends to ask for the money. If he does, what are you going to do with it? Because last time, for this first slice, you sort of changed strategy midstream there, and now you're taking a completely different direction. Will he ask for the authority to use the next $350 billion or exit?
Before he's going to ask for that, before he's going to ask for that money, Todd, I think Barney Franks, the chairman of the Financial Services Committee, we spoke with him last week, and he made it abundantly clear that he's going to be asking some questions about why the banks are not relending the money. If they are getting these billion-dollar checks from the Treasury, why is that not seen in a turnaround on the other side of it in the hands of consumers, whether you're talking about companies or individuals. And there's some question as to whether or not that money is actually being lent out.
Yeah, and he's and Mr. Frank has had that concern since this plan was even passed. I remember, you know, a couple of months ago. Well, I guess it was about 6 weeks ago now, before the bailout was even finalized. He was going around saying, "We're going to be bird dogging this plan. We're going to be watching it like a hawk, if I can use another bird metaphor, to make sure that the money gets used as it's intended." And it wasn't very long afterward, and before Mr. Frank called hearings even before the adjournment, to call Bank of America and some of the lenders onto the carpet to make sure they're lending the money the way he was led to believe they should, or whether he the way that he wants them to. He apparently still thinks that it's not going the way he wants to. So he'll be raising those questions today. And you can bet in the new Congress, this plan's going to be around. We're not going to be out of the woods once Senator Obama becomes President Obama. So these hearings will continue, there's no doubt.
All right, Todd. I want us to quickly go over to what I think of as the marital counseling portion of the lame duck session. Let's hear this from Senator Tom Carper, Democrat from Delaware, once again talking about Joe Lieberman.
Members will be able to say how they feel in their hearts to his face. He'll have the opportunity to speak to all of us from his heart. And somewhere at the end of that, we hope to find a balance that reflects our disappointment, our profound disappointment with his behavior as it pertains to Barack, and an opportunity to try to make sure that he stays in our caucus.
You know, Todd, they're not mad. They're just disappointed. So what is going to happen with Senator Lieberman on the Hill?
Well, he's going to face is it quite a jury? He's going to face a group of his peers today in the Democratic caucus. This is the classic behind wooden closed doors meeting, secret ballot. Lieberman faces his colleagues to answer for what Tom Carper was talking about, his behavior. His behavior, of course, not only supporting John McCain in the election, but speaking at the Republican National Convention, and not only speaking at the convention, but saying a couple of negative things about Barack Obama. And in the collegial world of the Senate, that is a no-no. A lot of them are very, very upset about it, and they want consequences. They want bad behavior to be punished, and that looks like it's going to be determined later on this morning.
Todd, what do you think the choices are? What are the options?
Well, okay, so you've got several. Option one is Lieberman could be kicked out of the caucus entirely. You no longer get to meet with us Democrats. We want you out of the club. Now, you heard Tom Carper say they don't want that to happen, and that's because of pragmatism. They want every vote they can get, and whether or not you are mad at him for supporting John McCain, Lieberman usually votes with the Democrats, so they want his vote. He has a committee chairmanship. That's the Homeland Security Committee and government oversight. He could be stripped of that. Now, Lieberman has suggested, it is said, nobody knows exactly the back and forth between he and Harry Reid. It has been suggested that Lieberman has said, if you push me too far, if you take away my chairmanship, I will just jump and go with the Republicans myself. He's not backing into this. Lieberman has been in the Senate a long time, and he made the choice to do this. So they could take away his committee chairmanships.
Okay, Todd Zwillick, we're going to have to leave it at that. Thanks for being with us, Todd Zwillick, Capital News Connection.
And as Todd was telling us on Capitol Hill today, they're going to be talking about the financial bailout plan. You're going to have the auto industry asking for billions to help their struggling industry. Where should these billions of dollars go? We want to hear your thoughts on that. 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at thetakeaway.org. Who should get some money first?
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Catherine Lanfer is in today for John Hockenberry. Good morning to you, Catherine.
Hey, Adora.
We're going to turn our attention to President-elect Barack Obama. He's been quite busy in the past 2 weeks since he won the election. He's met with his former rivals, Hillary Clinton, Senator Hillary Clinton, and he's also met with his former rival Republican, John McCain, and that happened yesterday. And the two men pledged to launch a new era of reform, targeting government waste and the Capitol's bitter partisanship. But the big question is, who is going to end up in his administration? There's certainly been lots of names that have been floated, but he's 2 weeks into it. And so we turn now to Lynn Sweet, who is the Washington Bureau Chief of the Chicago Sun-Times, someone who has much experience covering Barack Obama. Good morning. And one thing that the president-elect Obama said yesterday, Lynn, was that the national press is tame compared to the local press. Was he talking about you?
No. I was in Washington. But he was talking about what I think is the far more aggressive Chicago press corps. And I mean this, if you bring up a question that may be funny, but in a very serious way, the Chicago press corps has always been harder on President-elect Obama than the national press, partly because they knew him, weren't particularly starstruck, and weren't afraid just to shout some questions. That's what happened yesterday in general, but in particular, it's just been more of a give and take and less of a and Chicago press had always just been interested probably in some hard news questions. Obama's used to dealing with a press corps that has often very different agendas, so he gets very different types. He has the process gotten very different types of questions.
So having followed him, how would you describe this process of the transition team and some of the candidates perhaps they're looking at for various positions in his administration?
Well, I think the way that the transition is operating so far is entirely consistent with how he has run the campaign, and that is just calm and deliberate, with the exception of the Hillary Clinton potential appointment, fairly leak-free and deliberate. He is in no hurry. He knows he has to get this done. He doesn't feel a need to pop out a name before it's time. When the roast is cooked, it will come out of the oven.
But you did mention there was an exception there.
Yes.
This has been a campaign and now a transition group and soon to be an administration. The campaign was really known for not having any leaks. In fact, people joked, at least among journalists, that it was no drama Obama. Does it surprise you then that there was this leak, or do you think that it was on purpose and that there was some very intentional actions taking place there?
Well, what actually happened is that there was a situation that the Obama people couldn't control, and they just hate when that happens, when something gets out of their control. And I don't know exactly how the news got out. It was a great scoop for Andrea Mitchell of NBC News. But one thing that did happen is that Hillary Clinton had to get on a commercial flight to come to Chicago. So that alone could have gotten the war rolling, since she is the most recognized person and one of the most recognized people in the United States. That could have gotten a war rolling, that people then, you know, hit the phones knowing that she was coming to Chicago on a late afternoon flight. Maybe that's how the ball got rolling. I don't know. So
I was going to say, a lot of people were speculating that, in fact, it was a trial balloon.
Could be. It's not a bad one, given that there's so much out there that you have to think through in appointing Senator Clinton, because you do have to deal with President Clinton, and particularly in the job of Secretary of State. The former president has built a whole global foundation dealing with international issues, travels extensively, and one of the other issues is gets money probably from foreign sources to help fund the foundation. All that had to be digested and thought about by the transition team and by President-elect Obama, who, by the way, is with Vice President-elect Joe Biden in Chicago today with no public schedule, so maybe they're thinking about all this very closely. There's a lot of vetting to be done.
Okay, very quickly. I know James Carville says that in an election you stab your enemies, but during a transition you stab your friends. Who is most likely, do you think, to be disappointed when this cabinet is assembled?
Well, I think somebody who's a very partisan Democrat who's going to be disappointed, who did not understand that Obama does not intend that Obama is going to form a working coalition and put people in it that give him what he wants to get the votes needed when he needs them. So if you think that because President-elect Obama is the first president in 8 years that you're going to have all Democrats, all highly partisan people, you may be disappointed, or people with a very specific personal agenda that they're identified with. I would be, then you may be disappointed.
Lynn, last question, and we have about 20 seconds.
I'll be quick.
Valerie Jarrett is someone that is well-known in Chicago, but not necessarily as well-known nationally. She is a very close confidant of the Obamas, and she has been there from day one of this presidential campaign. And now she's in the middle of the transition. What can you tell her? Tell us about her.
Businesswoman. She is a CEO of a big real estate company in Chicago, a veteran of years and years in Chicago City Hall, different jobs there. She used to run the city's transit agency called the CTA. And here is one interesting note. The man that hired her in Chicago City Hall, a man by the name of Judd Minor, went back to private practice. Years later, would go on to hire a young Harvard lawyer by the name of Barack Obama.
Small world there in Chicago. Lynn Sweet, thanks so much for joining us. Lynn Sweet is the Washington Bureau Chief of the Chicago Sun-Times. Mark Garrison is with us in the studio, and he's got the latest headlines.
Thank you. Coming up on 28 minutes after the hour, in just a few minutes, Democratic senators will vote on whether independent Joe Lieberman can keep his chairmanship of the Homeland Security Committee. The former Democrat has mostly voted with the party since leaving it, but his support for John McCain has many Democrats ready to yank his gavel. The big three automakers are in the Capitol asking for some help. Two bills in the House and Senate will address if and how to fund loans for GM, Ford, and Chrysler. Supporters saying more money is needed to help keep jobs in the economy. The White House has criticized the Senate proposal. Both bills face a tough fight. Yahoo CEO Jerry Yang says he's stepping down as CEO. The board of directors may consider Yahoo President Susan Decker for the position. Microsoft says they have no new interest in buying Yahoo. A previous takeover bid by MS failed this spring. And as we've talked about, this is the day marked as Mickey Mouse's 80th birthday. Looks good for an octogenarian because Steamboat Willie came out. You know, it was a groundbreaking cartoon, but there was also some groundbreaking music. It proved that, you know, suckling pigs and goats could be musical instruments. Let's hear a little bit of the musical portion. So if you've never seen it all the way through, it's actually a lot of fun where they do the music at the end because he plays a goat, there's a trash can barrel, you know, pots and pans, a goose, you know, he kind of hits cow's teeth with a xylophone mallet. It's kind of like if you've ever seen the Arcade Fire in concert, it's a lot like
you're
that.
High, right? Like you're just high, right? You're just high. That's what's going on here.
No, I'm just appreciating cartoon music.
You're just reminiscing.
Yeah.
I'm not 80.
No, but they played these things over and over again for the last many, many moons.
Mark That's Garrison.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Catherine Lanfrey in for John Hockenberry. All of this talk about the economy and politics sometimes lets us lose sight of other things going on in the world. Okay, Adora, did you know that North America is facing one of its worst ecological disasters in recorded history?
Sounds very dire.
I know. Doesn't that wake everyone up a little? The mountain pine beetle, this is a bug that is native to our region, is killing millions of acres of pine forests. Warmer winters, the way humans use the land, they have all allowed the appetite of this beetle to go unchecked. Joining us today is Jim Robbins. He's a journalist who wrote a piece for the science section of today's New York Times about this mountain pine beetle infestation. All right, Jim. First of all, let's talk about where in North America is this happening?
Well, it's happening virtually from the southern Rockies all the way up to British Columbia and the northern Rockies through Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana, where I live. And it's hit in varying degrees in different places. And in the United States, Colorado is probably the worst state hit. Virtually, in a few years, virtually all of the high-altitude mountain lodgepole pine will be gone. And in Canada, British Columbia has probably been hit the hardest of all.
You know, it's sort of hard to wrap your mind around these numbers. The largest known insect infestation in the history of North America? Give me something that helps me get a sense of the scale.
Well, if you stand on a mountaintop in Colorado, you can look in every direction virtually in some places and see dead trees. I mean, it is everywhere. I live in Montana. I can stand on my front porch and look out and see probably a third of the trees across the valley dead and red on the mountainside. When they die, they turn from green to red, and it's a pretty striking color difference between a dead tree and a live tree, and it's very sobering.
Wow. All right. And this beetle, tell me about this beetle. What does it look like? What's the biology? Why is it hungry?
It's small and black in its adult stage. It's about the tip of your finger. It fit on the tip of your little finger. And it flies to a tree. It burrows in through the bark, and it lays eggs. And then when this rice grain-sized larva hatches, it burrows into the cambium, which is what it eats. And the cambium is that thin sheet of tissue between the bark and the wood part of the tree. And what that does is it cuts the nutrients off that the tree takes up from the ground and sends up to the crown. And so essentially it cuts the lifeline off that the tree has for feeding itself. And then those grubs hatch, and then they fly onto other trees. So it becomes this kind of exponential progress as they grow to adulthood and then fly off to other trees. And you can see year after year, you see one tree, then you see 10, and then you see 100. And so it's this steady growth into the forest, and the trees turn red.
And this steady growth has essentially led to some campgrounds being closed, some ski resorts, lumber yards losing money. What's the effort to do something about these beetles?
It's very difficult. I mean, it's really hard to salvage this wood because it's after it's killed by the beetle, it's very light and it's hard to use structurally. It gets a blue stain that the bugs inject into it to stop the sap from rising, and that stain makes the wood worthless. Now, some furniture makers are using that blue stain as kind of an enhanced value for their product, but really it's a tough sell for 2x4s and those kinds of things.
Jim, how do you kill the beetles?
Well, you don't. Nature has to kill the beetles. It has to get really cold. It has to get 25, 30, 35 below zero for a few weeks in order for these beetles to die. And so that hasn't happened since the 1980s out here. And so what we have to do is hope for cold weather and hope that nature does the job, because there's just too many. It's too big an area for humans to make a difference.
And what have humans done to make this possible? We were talking in the introduction about how part of this is because of human activity.
Well, the big thing is climate change. We've so warmed the planet that we don't get these cold weathers anymore, and so this beetle can spread far beyond its normal range. It's spreading all over the West. And the other thing we've done is suppressed fires. Now, fires would come along every 7 to 10 years and clean out a lot of the forest and reduce the number of trees. Well, what's happened is humans have stopped fighting fires over the last, or excuse me, have fought fires over the last 100 years. And what that's done is given the beetle more of a foothold, more trees to eat, and it's led to what they call a decadent forest, which makes the beetle more at home.
All right. Jim Robbins, I want to thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
And that is Jim Robbins, author of a piece on pine beetles in today's Science Times, part of today's New York Times. Look for images and video of the mountain pine beetle's wrath on our website, thetakeaway.org. And now we're going to turn things over to Mark Garrison, stepping in for Femi Oke from the newsroom.
Sure. It's 22 minutes before the hour. We're going to take a listen to some live coverage from the Hill. I see Democratic Chairman Barney Frank is talking now. They're going to be grilling Hank Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke.
And what we have done so far is lower than anybody would have wanted to be, to the point where it could be an obstacle to further steps. So, because I want to keep strictly to the time for everybody, I will just reiterate, it is essential that we do something to use some of the TARP funds for the diminution of the rate of mortgage foreclosures. And the chair of the FDIC, whom we have invited, has been very much in the lead on this. No one here is endorsing any specific plan, but the need to use TARP funds as the bill contemplates to reduce foreclosures is paramount. John from Alabama.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for holding the hearing, and I welcome Secretary Paulson and Chairman Bernanke and Chairman Baer, and I appreciate your service to the country.
That's live coverage of Testimony on the Hill. Hank Paulson and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke are going to be testifying. You're just hearing basically the opening statements of the Democratic chair and the Republican ranking member. They're talking about, you heard him mention the TARP. They're essentially talking about the change of the plan. Now they're injecting money directly into banks. Initially, they were supposed to use that money to buy up troubled assets and work with that. Other big economic news out just this morning, wholesale prices plunged a record amount last month. They're down 2.8%. That is the biggest drop in more than two decades. That could mean a tough day on Wall Street, which is open for business right now. There's also a lot of nervousness about the auto industry. Heads of the big three automakers also testifying on Capitol Hill today. They would love a piece of that $700 billion bailout plan that's being talked about right now. And a Somali official is vowing to rescue a hijacked Saudi oil tanker by using force if necessary. Somalia's deputy seaport minister, if the ship anchors anywhere near the spot where it's reportedly been headed, his forces will rescue it. And the Endeavour astronauts are in space at the moment. They're working on the International Space Station. They just got woken up about 30 minutes ago. And, you know, they're highly trained. These are talented people. But sometimes their chores are a little bit more mundane.
We're going to be moving our nitrogen tank assembly from external stowage platform number 3 over to the payload bay.
Ah, the old platform 3 to the payload bay. It's a, you know, so you're floating and you're in space. You got this cool suit on. You're highly trained. But sometimes you just have to kind of, you know, clean out the attic and put it somewhere else like that. So, you know, but they're doing well up there.
All right. Thanks for the news, Payload Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
It is Tuesday, November 18th. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockaway here on The Takeaway.
Hockenberry. You said Hockaway.
Did I really?
I'm going to call him that tomorrow. Anyhow, I'm Adora Udoji. New reports show that Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri Kamal al-Maliki's government has been systematically dismissing Iraqi oversight officials. These officials were placed by the American Occupation Administration as a way to fight corruption in Iraq's ministries. But that corruption may still exist, and there may be no one watching them. For more, we go to Baghdad correspondent for the New York Times, James Glantz. He is the partner there. Actually, he is the bureau chief there for our partners at the New York Times. Good morning. Thanks for joining us, James. And at a time when there has been testimony of billions of dollars that have been lost, U.S. money that have been lost to embezzlement and fraud in Iraq, why in the world would the government be getting rid of people who are charged with overseeing that that does not happen?
Right. Well, given the amount of money that the United States has spent on reconstruction in Iraq, you could call that the $50 billion question. No one is quite sure. It's unclear exactly what the motivations were, but it doesn't appear to have been tailored to increase the transparency of the Iraqi bureaucracy that is spending that money and, in some cases, not doing it very well, as you know from those reports.
So who got dismissed, and apparently it was done in secret until reporters like yourself started asking questions, right?
Right. I found out about it in conjunction with one of my Iraqi colleagues and one of our wonderful Iraqi reporters in the newsroom in Baghdad, Riyad Mohammed. But it was done completely without any public announcement, and it was said by the cabinet-level committee that vetted the inspectors general in the Iraqi ministries that these inspectors general were not competent, but that assertion has been challenged on several fronts since we started the reporting and, of course, by those inspectors general themselves.
And, James, what do you make of it?
Well, it's hard to say because what we found out is that this operation was taking place behind the scenes. We determined that one of the people involved in this was a replacement for the chief of something called the Commission for Public Integrity, which is charged to root out corruption in Iraq. But that chief was someone who had been installed in that position by the prime minister because he didn't like the person who had been there before. That person, Judge Roddy, is now under asylum in the United States because he feared for his life and fled Iraq. So there are indications that this wasn't done exactly properly, but the Maliki government is saying that's not the case. They did it entirely for professional reasons, trying to find the best office holders in those positions, inspector general in different ministries, and that they had picked the ones who were not performing, and they were rooting those out. That's their assertion.
No doubt. More to that story. James Glantz, thanks so much for joining us. James Glantz is the New York Times bureau chief in Baghdad.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It's Tuesday, November 18th. Mark Garrison is here to bring us up to date on all the stories of the morning.
Thank you. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, the Dow opened up a bit today. At the moment, the Dow is up about 60 points. That's just over half a percentage point gain. The head of Ford Motor Company is defending his company. He says they're working hard to make the business more profitable. Alan Mulally spoke to CNN saying Ford will absolutely change the company to justify any large sums of taxpayer money it would get. This as the big three automakers are all on the Hill today. They're testifying and building a case they should get a big chunk of the $700 billion bailout package. Hewlett-Packard said quarterly and yearly profits are going to be better than expected. HP is the largest maker of personal computers in the world. However, luxury retailer Saks says its earnings are down. Wealthy customers are cutting back their spending and on their there and in stores and on the website. The New York-based retailer lost $42.8 million or 31 cents per share in the previous quarter. And that is the news.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark. Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. So good morning to you, Catherine.
Oh, thanks, Dora.
And we're going to move to Phoenix, Arizona, where officials are saying that Mexico's drug war has jumped the border. The number of violent kidnappings in the city and the surrounding areas has spiked. And more importantly, officials say, the attacks have gotten bolder. For more of the story, we go to Mark Moran, the news director of KJZZ in Phoenix. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
So explain to us what law enforcement officials are saying is happening.
Well, it's complicated. I mean, for years, Phoenix has been kind of a hotbed of smuggling. In the old days, it used to be a kind of a nod and a wink in terms of illegal immigrants being smuggled across the border by smugglers known here as coyotes, who take money once you're smuggled across the border, and you go off and do your thing if you're an immigrant coming in undocumented, and the coyotes go back across the border and bring their next load. Well, as the border security has tightened in Phoenix and Texas and other border states, it's gotten a lot harder to smuggle not only people, but drugs across the border. So obviously the stakes are higher, the prices are higher, the level of danger goes way up. And what you have evolving is a turf war among these coyotes or these smugglers who say, well, this is my route. This is where I smuggle my immigrants, or this is where I smuggle my drugs. And to prove it, if you try to get onto my turf, I'm going to kill you, or I'm going to kidnap members of your family. It goes beyond that, too, in terms of just the level of money involved.
The numbers here are shocking. 266 reported kidnappings in Phoenix, and that's just the reported number.
Right. The number is, don't pay any attention to the numbers. It's sort of like the guy behind the curtain. You never really know how many bodies are out in the desert. You don't know. And the police will tell you that kind of off the record. We don't know how bad this problem is, but we know it's a bad problem because we've got specific task forces designed to deal specifically with it. But to give you an idea of how serious these guys are about their turf, there was one instance, and I know there's been instances all over the country actually now, some of these drug cartels, but they will you'll be a known smuggler, and there'll be another smuggler who knows who you are, and maybe he'll decide that he wants this turf badly enough, or just wants your cash badly enough that you've gotten from the people that you've smuggled, the drugs that you've sold, that someone from his gang will kidnap a family member of the other guy's gang or cartel and demand ransom of up to $1 million. And so it's whether or not they actually have the person or not, there's also these virtual kidnappings where they'll call and say, hey, I've got your wife here. No, I'm not going to put her on the phone. You're going to have to believe me. And I'm going to kill her if you don't give me $500,000 and you know where to meet me. So there is no border in this drug war anymore. It's just sort of a region. But it's very serious and the stakes are very high, and so are the dollars.
Mark, is it fair to say this is spilling over from Mexico, where they have seen a skyrocketing murder rate? Over 3,000 people have been killed there this year, and they're attributing it to these drug gangs fighting over control of smuggling routes into California, Arizona, and Texas. Is it all part of the same thing?
It is. It's all part of the same thing. And, you know, like I said before, it used to just be people and, you know, you'd smuggle across 15 or 20 people and they'd go on their way and you'd take your $1,000 or whatever it was as a smuggler. But as the border has become tightened, the stakes are higher. And, yeah, it's just a full-blown turf war, and the stakes are now. So it's not just drugs and people either. There's also guns that get smuggled across the border. And they're very serious about defending their turf, serious enough to kill people, to hold them up for their money, and to abduct family members as well.
If we can't go by the numbers, how do we know that it's gotten worse?
Well, because the police are saying, you know, they're busier than ever with this. There are certain ways you can tell just by, you know, when you interview somebody, you can see the look on their face, and this is an epidemic. I mean, this has been several years ago now. I went out into the desert off of Interstate 10, and not very far off of Interstate 10 either. That was a kind of a prime dumping ground for people who would be killed and dumped in the desert. And we had a spate here where there was 2 and 3 a week, which had never happened before. And that's just one little area off of Interstate 10 that the police happen to know about and were willing to talk about. You just get a feel. I know it's not a good answer to say, well, I can't say there's 25 now and 150 this week, but you get a feel when something is bad from the police, even if they're not going to give you specific numbers about how bad things are. You can just kind of tell, if you will.
Mark, it sounds like some of these incidences are incredibly bold, snatching people from malls, running people off the side of the road in their cars. Is this something that you see out in the open, or for the most part, what you're reporting to us, is this happening under the radar?
It's very much under the radar. I mean, there are places in every city that you don't want to go, but it's not like I can take you down to a part of Phoenix and say, look at that guy, he's a smuggler, or look at that guy, he's working for a smuggler. Obviously, you can drive around street corners now almost any place in America and tell who illegal immigrants are who've been brought across and just want a job, looking for work. But it's very complex. And I want to go back to something you said a second ago about how bold some of these crimes are. There was a teenage girl standing out in front of a house in South Phoenix. The house was believed to be that of a drug smuggler. And they knew that this drug smuggler had family and had teenage kids. Well, somebody from a rival cartel pulled up in a car, snatched this girl, threw her in the back of the car, drove away, called the guy and said, hey, we've got your daughter, and we're going to kill her if we don't get X number of dollars. As it turned out, the girl was not even related to that family member, and one way or another, she wound up being freed unharmed. But you mentioned bold. That's about as bold as it gets. I think she was 13 or 14 years old and was not even related to them. They just assumed that she was, and they snatched her.
What kind of impact is this going to have on people who aren't involved in this? Do you have people, literally other shoppers at malls, other people standing around in neighborhoods who are also at risk?
I don't think so. I mean, the parts of town and the parts of the city of Phoenix where this typically happens, I don't spend a lot of time in parts of Phoenix where there are a lot of gangs. But just from what I've heard and from people I've talked to, people on our Latino Affairs desk have not said that it's a huge problem where you have to be afraid to go to the mall. Generally, people who are involved in this and their family members tend to know it, unless you're an innocent 13-year-old girl standing in front of somebody's house who happens to be a smuggler. I don't want to say the danger rate has gone through the roof and people are looking over their shoulders at shopping malls and things like that. I wouldn't say that's happening.
Mark, last question for you. What is law enforcement doing, and is it some kind of joint task force where you're talking about both state, local, and federal officers or detectives are involved?
Everybody's involved, even into the ICE. The Customs Enforcement Bureau is involved in this, as well as local police. But they can only do so much. It's kind of like enforcing the border laws. I mean, if you have smugglers who are willing to smuggle people across for a certain number of dollars, and the higher that price goes, the more risks they're willing to take. I mean, Border Patrol agents will tell you it's hard to defend the border. It really is. And it's hard to hire Border Patrol agents for what they get paid. But I guess back to your original question, yes, everyone is involved in this, right down to local police. The Maricopa County Sheriff here, whom you all know as Sheriff Joe, who's supposedly the quote-unquote toughest sheriff in America, is very involved, at least talking about trying to slow illegal immigrants, but also trying to stop this this drug trafficking. And he has actually reached out to local law enforcement agencies, Phoenix police, suburban police around Phoenix, to really try to crack down and to give them the authority to do usually what the county sheriff would, which is to try to, you know, make arrests when they see things happening and to try to slow this down. But it's very difficult. Frankly, the police are outmanned in some instances. The smugglers who are coming across are using more sophisticated weapons than the police have. So it's a very difficult challenge.
Mark Moran, many thanks for that report.
You're welcome.
Mark Moran is the news director for KJZZ, and he joined us from Phoenix.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. The government's $700 billion financial bailout tops the agenda today, and the big three automakers pleading for $25 billion of that loan. We want to hear what you think. With all of this money, what else does Congress need to fix right now?
I think that they bailed out the banks, the insurance companies. Now they're bailing out the homeowners. What about the people who didn't do any of those bad things and have 401ks that have tanked and are going to retire? Where will they get that money? They have to use some of that money to help those people, too.
There's a point for you. We want to hear your thoughts, 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. We're also following Detroit and automakers as they ask politicians in Washington for money. Here's a takeaway.
Some executives from GM have said, we might not be here in January when you guys come back. Or if we do, we'll be further damaged. It will be even more expensive to save this industry then. So cheaper to do something now than to do something in January or February.
That's our pal Todd Zwillick from PRI's Capital News Connection. We're always on here at The Takeaway. And if you missed anything, you can catch our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes.
I'm Catherine Lanfer.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.